I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. What if every social impact organization had the resources and capacity it needed to do its work at the highest level? Think of how much easier it would be for do-gooders to do good. Enter EM4.
EM4 is an organization dedicated to building out the capacity of social impact organizations around the world, particularly those in the global south where access to resources is most limited. In this episode, we're speaking with two of EM4's founders, Donna Reitano and Ajay Mehta, about their approach to organizational development and their advice for others trying to make a difference.
Here is Donna and Ajay.
Hello, my name is Donna Reitano. Thank you to Pot of Gold for this opportunity to meet with listeners today. I'm one of the co-founders of EM4. We're based in Scotland and in England and also in Switzerland and France. And we work on building capacity and competencies in the social impact sector. What we mean by social impact is NGOs and associations, basically what's commonly called the nonprofit organization or the nonprofit sector. I come from this sector with about 20 plus years experience working in NGOs and associations, primarily in Europe. And I've associated with Ajay, who's here with us today, and also Neil, who's in Dundee in Scotland. And we formed EM4 about 3 years ago.
Hi, my name's Ajay, as Donna introduced me also. And I joined, Donna and I were inspired and, to create something that was quite different in the sector to try and solve some of the critical issues that are facing organizations, nonprofit organizations in the world, really. And our values had aligned, and we realized that we need to do something that would perhaps create a little dent in the whole space of trying to create some transformational change. Particularly, we were bothered about the inequalities that exist in our sector, in the social impact sector, particularly in relation to the global north and global south. And in terms of my own personal background, I've been in the social impact sector for over 20 years, just like Donna. I've worked with local organizations in the UK, with national organizations and with international organizations. And I've run a foundation that funds health projects in sub-Saharan Africa. So a lot of my work is international, internationally based. And so Donna introduced me to our colleague, Neil, who's, as Donna says, based in Dundee in Scotland. And Neil's the geek in our family, so in our little EM4 family. So we thought we would put together something that is very unique, which is sort of offering digital-based solutions to solving some of the capacity-building challenges in our sector.
Wow, we're basically sitting here with 50 years of experience. When you say you got inspired, you two got inspired by what exactly? What's the inspiration which kind of drew you two together to create EM4? And then what is EM4 standing for exactly?
Well, EM4 stands for Enabling Missions in 4 Stages. So much, EM4 is a much nicer title. I was inspired by problems. There's so many challenges in the sector. So many talented people, so much empathy and compassion, and so little vision of how to make the sector viable and sustainable. And it's often been frustrating to see so much talent and so many wonderful ideas and so much compassion for what needs to be done in the world, but with fairly little business acumen, if you will. And we saw together that there was really a need to develop some capacities so that these organizations could really fulfill their dreams, which are the dreams of society as well.
The term social impact has kind of become a buzzword everywhere. You know, the social impact investing and social impact corporate structures and on and on. And I think sometimes people are at a loss to really understand what that is. I mean, it's a huge sector when you talk about anything that does good for the planet or for people. How do you guys think about social impact specifically and where the focus should be on that huge domain?
Well, I think for me, it's really around sort of tackling the inequalities. And I think you're absolutely right. I think the term social impact is bandied around quite a lot, and sometimes with meaning, sometimes without. And I think some organizations would claim to make social impact when there's little evidence of it, or it's not monitored and evaluated. So very difficult to measure. I think for us, when we assess organizations, and one of our key stages, one of the four stages that Donna alluded to, is the assessment stage. This is the stage where we do try and get under the skin of an organization to dive deep into the organization and see where some of the challenges might lie. So if an organization, for example, claims to achieve social impact, really the truth is in what we can uncover when we do the deep dive and see if they are financially sustainable, if they have a good governance and model in place, they have effective leadership. And actually one of the areas we look at is impact itself.
Well, you might as well tell us the other three stages while we're at it. And I have some questions going back to social impact, but what are the other three after assessment? What happens?
Well, first we assess and we decide what's good in the organization, what's not so good, what needs fixing. So we have a whole delivery program, which is based on a blended learning. We have a direct contact with organizations, training, action learning in groups, and we also write our own e-learning courses. So that's the whole delivery part. And then we have an evaluation where we monitor and evaluate progress on the different points. And then at the end, there's a support, the support network. And we have development on a community of practice for to put different organizations in contact with each other, so that consultants that we use can learn from each other, but also organizations can learn from each other. Funders can also learn from each other and learn from their grantees. And all of this is on a digital platform called Cloud Rooms that we use.
Awesome. So that's, as you said, like a Udemy kind of for nonprofits, you know, kind of a...
Yes.
And also a Zagat's, maybe. You might want to go to the if you were to publish the ratings of a nonprofit, right? You could look at that. Do you ascribe to the 17, what are they called, global...
Sustainability
goals as the kind of metric of social impact? Do you think that's a good measurement?
That's a great, really good question. I think the organizations that we work with are all more or less in tune with the SDGs, and it's a guiding light for us. All of these organizations are working towards each of the SDGs. So in that way, we are in that general matrix.
Yeah, I would agree. I think as we developed our regional strategy, so in other words, when we set up a base in Kenya, for example, we were talking about organizations that in the region, so in the Kenyan region, but also in the wider East African region of Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda, for example, we were looking at a model where we could look at the indices, the SDG index, and see where countries were in the index, and then look at organizations that were actually, whose missions were very much about the SDGs. But it's very difficult to just kind of go and work with any organization. I think we rely on the local expertise in those regions to guide us. And they're the ones who would shortlist organizations who whose mission and values are very much in line with the SDGs.
I'm happy you brought that the subject of regional partners, Ajay. What we really want to be able to do is to give a fully researched and working model of capacity building to a person or an organization in a country, principally in the Global South, so that that person also can begin to have a business and build a team. So with our model, our tools and templates, that person will be able to create employment for herself or himself and also a team of people. And we've begun doing that already in four or five countries.
Are those like the business? Is it usually a nonprofit enterprise, or is it a for-profit business, or does it matter to you?
For the moment, these are for-profit businesses that are occurring, but they're very much based on social impact sector pricing, if you will. So we have the same pricing that you would find in local NGOs or associations, the same levels of remuneration, for example. But the expertise of the people that we're working with right now extend past the nonprofit sector. For example, we have an expert in small and medium enterprises, for example. And with these startup organizations, it's actually the same skill set that we need for capacity building in NGOs.
Right. Do you have a practical example?
Well, I think, Ajay, the example in Kenya is probably our best example of working with an expert there who has a lot of experience in SMEs, a lot of experience in financial modeling for startups and SMEs. And she is building a team to work on capacity building using the tools and templates of the M4. And she has run so far two assessments and is now working on moving towards the solutions package, if you will, or the action, putting it together in action. And her expertise is exciting for us because of the parallels of the business acumen that's needed in SMEs being transferred over to the nonprofit sector. It's really good experience.
So I see this, the focus is you empower young entrepreneurs, for lack of a better word, whether in the social impact sector, to become successful in building out their organizations. And I wonder if we can look at this from a global perspective, and how do you see the nonprofit sector? Do you see the nonprofit sector as the main driver of change toward just and sustainable world, or do you see it as do you see this as a collaboration with private sector enterprises? I mean, I guess one of the things that I was interested in when we started a nonprofit, so everyone told us, or several people told me, why are you starting a nonprofit? Why don't you just go join UNICEF? Or why don't you just go join whichever one matches you the best, and instead of trying to start a new one? And that struck me as kind of strange, because if I'd said I want a for-profit, everyone's like, yeah, go do it. You know? But a nonprofit isn't, yeah, go do it. It's like, it's too much hassle. Go join another organization. And I wonder if that's something that you've come across, or something you deal with, and do you see this nonprofit sector burgeoning as a real force, economic force, or are we really talking about just moving things in a for-profit direction altogether?
Well, I think for me, it's an interesting area again, and I think when we look at this through the global lens, you see the difference and disparities between larger INGOs, so international nonprofit organizations, and the smaller local organizations. And there's been this debate for quite a few years now about the power imbalance between the two. So actually, you can have a large international NGO working locally, let's say in the Philippines, and the larger organization based usually in the West, usually seen as a white organization, come to rescue the poor Black people. And I think this is a controversial, very much a sort of a necessary issue, you know, something that we do need to tackle, actually. But it's been there for a few years now, and that, you know, larger organizations are often criticized because they attract the funding, they get the platform, they get to go to international conferences, they get the media profile, they get the accolades and the awards, because they might be doing some work in the Philippines, for example. And yet the small organization in the Philippines often struggles to get its civic space and to get its, you know, to be recognized, et cetera. And it's almost like it exists with a begging bowl, waiting for, you know, larger organizations or, you know, who they would partner with, which is not, it's not strictly good partnership working, but that's how it is. And often this is the issue with such organizations. And then you get larger organizations sending somebody, you know, if it's a project in Africa, it'll be an African expert. And yet that African expert will be based in the capital city for one or two years. And they, you know, they've solved the problem. So I think the whole context around globalization, particularly around the nonprofit sector, it's very interesting.
It's interesting how competition always seeps through in these issues. We think that competition is corporate and it's a for-profit phenomenon, but chasing after rare funding is competitive business. And what we're hoping at EM4 is that by working with funders and having them entrust us with their grantees so that we can build capacity, that we can help them to have a larger picture about how to solve problems in different regions without that competitive edge of the larger organizations getting more funding because they're more well-known and the smaller local partners being left on the side of the road, for example. And that's quite ambitious, as Ajay was saying, but we are working towards that.
What is the exact size of the sector that you're talking about? How big are we talking in terms of your general south, let's say south of the equator, nonprofit sector or social impact sector?
It's absolutely enormous. This is not the Global South, but we have a partnership in France, and the nonprofit sector represents 10% of the French economy, for example. In Eastern Africa, and Ajay, you might be able to speak with this with more confidence than I, but in Eastern Africa, for example, Kenya and Uganda, the nonprofit sector is absolutely enormous, and it is producing sustainable agriculture. It is feeding people. It is providing housing for the poor. In South Asia and Southeastern Asia, the same thing. So it represents a huge portion of the economy.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these organizations will be unorganized. Actually, will be unorganized, unrecognized, not registered. Mm-hmm. A lot of them will be movements, and actually, it is about local movements that activism that goes on, etc. I mean, so it's massive. Very difficult to quantify. And I think the people we work with locally are the ones who can help to identify. And actually, Donna spoke about the Kenya example. One of the organizations that was shortlisted was a very tiny organization that dealt with issues around sanitation, for example, and the impact on the local community. You know, and the organization doesn't even have a website. But actually the work they do is, you know, really, you know, high, you know, they deliver high social impact in the communities. They're really well known in the local communities. You and I wouldn't have heard of them. So I think these are the interesting areas for us that we want to rely on the local expertise to tell us, you know, where the need is the greatest, and then where we are able to build their capacities where we can.
And the sector has inherited from the global north the idea that if you can't measure something, it doesn't exist, and that metrics are extremely important in every circumstance. And case in point to what Ajay has just said, much of the social impact work that's going on in the global south is very difficult to measure. And quite often, activities are being funded according to metrics that really have very little to do with what's going on the ground.
That goes exactly to what my next question was going to be, and that is about metrics. Because I think from our own perspective even, certain things that are changing minds, shifting attitudes, changing behaviors, addressing systemic underlying causes are really difficult to apply metrics to in the immediate sense, in kind of the, we did this, this, and this, please fund me, because oftentimes these metrics are number of people impacted, number of people served, how many kids did you talk to? And I wonder if there's a way in which the metric, that whole paradigm of metrics could change to be more embracing of those local perspectives and also some of these more systemic necessities. You know, how do we really change in a transformative way these systems? Which the metrics will come, but much, much later down the line, after the funding cycles are over.
I'm not, you know, disheartened by the idea of measurement, in that there's some very wonderful funders who actually have talented program managers who know how to evaluate worth and impact in other ways than mathematical formulas or some type of metric. So it's not all bleak. There are some very good evaluation organizations, one of which we work with on monitoring and evaluation. And they actually do, it's perhaps not very ecological, but they do get on an airplane and they do go down and observe what's going on. In the areas where they're being funded, so it's not all, you know, bleak, but there is a tendency, I think, for some a gap or some removal between what's actually going on the ground and what the funder sees. Do you is that your observation as well, Ajay?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And I think that there's nothing more powerful than good storytelling. So you can have the numbers, you can have how many children went to school and, or, you know, how many classrooms have been built or whatever. And I think that's fair enough to have sort of monitoring data information like that. But where we can really see some shifts in education and livelihoods, for example, difference made to families. Those are the stories that we can try and collect locally, and it doesn't really require sort of lengthy forms to be filled. But it does, you know, it does need local eyes and ears to capture powerful stories. So I think there is something about sort of a holistic way of looking at monitoring and evaluation, and it's really. It's much more than numbers, I think. So when we look at metrics, they are absolutely important, because funders do want to see the numbers, because that's how they measure their own effectiveness and see value for money for them. But actually, at DM4, we see, you know, we think it's our place also to try and educate, to learn, but also to educate, you know, so that collectively, you know, we bring about some positive change.
All right. We have a wrap-up question for you. And it's really for our listeners who are generally people very committed and passionate about making social impact. And we wonder if you could offer advice for anyone interested in joining an organization or starting an organization to really make meaningful change, either in their communities or in the world at large. What's the top three things that you would advise them?
For me, I think it's really about being true to yourself, and it's really about your own personal values and how, you know, where they sit and what you could do to make a difference in community. That's stating the obvious, but actually often we are not in tune with our own values and beliefs. We don't really know what we want. We don't really know what brings us happiness. We don't really know quite a few things to do with, you know, how we can live a more fulfilling life. So I think it's all about a journey of discovery. Because there are so many opportunities out there.
I think also what we find in the organizations that we try to help and assist is that when we talk about the nonprofit sector, it's not really a nonprofit sector, because organizations who don't make money don't stay around. So basically, social impact sector is probably a better way of phrasing that, because these organizations do need to have a solid business model as to what their market is. And this is business language, what their competition is, what their potential partnerships are, who the potential funding is going to come from, what kind of story they can tell, who they're surrounded by, what kind of talent they have, and building partnerships, not necessarily going into it as if, you know, with a killer attitude of, you know, we've got the best model on how to solve this particular problem, and therefore we're going to succeed. It's going in with a lot of humility, as Ajay said, with values, and trusting yourself and believing in what you're doing, but with your eyes wide open. It's quite a challenge.
Good advice. Well, thank you both so much for a lovely interview and for giving our listeners an insight into the world of social impact.
Let's just talk about competition.
Well, before we talk about competition, I mean, I think it's interesting to point that whether you're for-profit or non-profit, you're still vying for resources, right? You're still competing for resources. And I think one of the things that their EM4 is really helping people is to how to source their organization, how to make sure that they can make the good they need to make.
Well, what I thought was very interesting, you know, is that they're trying to find people who would normally not maybe have these kind of connections, especially in the South. I thought that was interesting. So sort of this is with the inherent competition, right? From like the where you're from makes a huge impact on whether you actually have access to resources or not.
Yeah, that is true. And I think the point of really focusing on local leaders. Like I remember this coming up in our episode with the Red Cross, right? Mm-hmm. The Red Cross had shifted models completely to this kind of global organization, to one that works very hard to find leaders on the ground in that community and then let them kind of lead the way and just provide funding and support for that group. And it feels like EM4 is even going a step further in that they're really focusing capacity development in local communities in the Southern Hemisphere, where there's, like you said, no vitamin C.
Which means vitamin contacts for a lot of people who don't know what vitamin C means.
Vitamin C is necessary for everyone.
Very good, Mel. Very good. I find this thing with competition really quite a difficult one because, first of all, I don't know. Do we really need competition in this world in order to overcome all these world problems we have? Or can we switch into collaboration? I actually don't know whether we need a bit of competition within the collaboration too. You know, if we really intrinsically as a human need competition in order to like show the best selves.
That's a good question. I think it's it's kind of an eternal question about what it means to be human. But I actually believe just watching children in a playground, for example, you see examples of competition and collaboration all the time. And I think some people are really motivated quite intrinsically by competition. They want to beat out other people or other companies or other, I wish that weren't necessarily our dominant characteristic, and maybe we can balance it out, but I'm not sure we can get rid of competition as a motivating factor. Look at you, you're competitive.
Yeah, and you.
I'm not competitive. You're the world-class sailor. I'm not world killer. I'm not beating anybody.
Oh, no, just running for office twice.
That's probably the purest. How competition actually is worthy in terms of reflecting the vision and desire of the collective. I mean, there's an example, representative democracy. How would you achieve it without some kind of competitive process? How would you actually engage the reflection of all the collective without a competition?
Well, if there wouldn't be our dear money in that competition when you now talk American politics, I would probably agree with
money,
you.
I see.
But as I do think this entire process is pretty much spoiled by who can afford what and hence pay off people.
Or who's better at collecting from people.
And then what?
Or who's better at raising money from people who can afford to give.
Yeah, and that's a statement in a tipping culture. I mean, Mel, there is corruption throughout. I mean, sorry. Okay, let's just focus.
I feel like we're getting offline a little bit here from Donna and Ajay.
Back on topic here.
There is a point about, I think there you are making actually a really good point, and that is it might be the case that when you introduce money into the context of whatever it is you're trying to achieve, competition becomes really about the money and not about the substance of what you're trying to achieve. So like sail racing.
Yeah, that was clearly not
was,
about the money.
It's not about the money. And originally democracy, where you're vying for people's votes, was not about the money. But now we've introduced money into that process quite heavily. Maybe because we have so many people, we have to reach them all. And how do you do that without money? But you could make it government, I guess.
Yeah, it said limits.
Yeah. But I guess that's the real question, competition around money versus competition that's just intrinsic to whatever you're doing.
Right, and this is because, I guess, we are so unconsciously dealing with money currently, where we basically only stand in this one dimension of how to get rich and how to get more. And that competition clearly is only about one winner.
Right. And maybe the real question, we're getting way off here, but maybe the real question is why is money so fungible? In other words, nowadays you can use money to get anything, really, literally anything. And what if we limited what you could actually use money for? We could also add other currencies and other purpose-driven currencies. But what if we actually limited what you could use the fiat money for? You cannot use it for politics. You cannot use
it
for...
Well, isn't that a proposal which is already on the table? Like, we interviewed Michael, King.
Yeah.
That was a nice episode about how
money has screwed
politics
it all up.
Politics is corrupted, basically, by money.
Yeah.
And how money is for running sure. politics in the United States, at least. Well, I guess everywhere else, really, too. I mean, it's
yeah, but that's, everyone has a piece of that pie. Media has a piece of that pie. You know, communication agencies have a piece of that pie. Consultants. I mean, it's just, it's become an industry, as does often happen. I think money's just too useful. Circling back to social impact, that's a really good question. So the world's problems are climate change and economic disparity, poverty, hunger, disease. Those are social impacts, right? And how do you solve those problems? Well, the question is, I think everyone has to try to solve those problems, but sometimes money, the pursuit of money, causes those problems, but possibly we could make those solving those problems profitable, in which case money would incentivize solving those problems. So
you
money,
know what I actually
money
see?
Could have impact either way.
Right. I see more and more, even on those startup platforms, that more and more impact-driven for-profit companies come on stage. I don't know whether this is just having a green label kind of, now it's a climate change label on it. Whether this is for real or, you know, what is the real impact, but there's definitely a certain, let's say, level up of how many more companies are even getting to a pitch to maybe get investors at a...
Yeah, I mean, I think investors and consumers are starting to become conscious, more conscious, and demanding that for-profit enterprises have a social impact, that they don't... They do no harm, and in fact, they do some good. And that's very important because it does change the profit model, right? You can't have a profit if you don't have people buying your stuff because you're not good for the environment. So that's one perspective. But then there's this other perspective is, I mean, I know a lot of companies that are very rated very high on climate social impact, but if you look at their labor practices, they're pretty bad. Like, you know, they're not paying people good wages. They're not, you know, so you might excel in one area of social impact and completely, you know, trade that off with your savings in another area where you're not being so great. And I think that's really the next level question is, how do you create a rubric of social impact that really doesn't allow that kind of, all right, we'll do well on the environment, but we'll screw our employees. Or, you know, we'll pay everyone and give them all parenting leave, but, you know, we'll throw the trash out the back into the river. So, like, you know, I think there's a long way to go in this area for for-profit companies.
Whereas, so competition is good in the end?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on the context.
Wonderful. We are back to start.
Hallelujah.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.